Programming is supported by Topline Construction Firm, your local women-owned roofing contractor based out of Shoreview, Minnesota. Roof replacement, both retail and insurance work. More information at toplineconstructionfirm.com.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.
You're listening to a recording of a live radio show on NPR News. If you want to listen to us in real time, you can stream our show live weekdays at 11 a.m. Central. Thanks for listening and enjoy the show.
This is NPR News. I'm Angela Davis. Has anyone ever said to you, maybe you should see someone about that, or said, maybe a therapist could help you with that? Stress, anxiety, depression are a part of life, but many people find it difficult to manage their feelings on their own and benefit from being on medication or talking with a therapist on a regular basis. Getting treatment for a mental health condition has become a lot more common than it used to be, and that's a good thing. What's not so good is that the demand for help has now exceeded the supply. The Minnesota Department of Human Services reports that 1 in 5 Minnesotans is facing some sort of mental health condition each year, but there just aren't enough professionals to help. Today, we are stepping into what can be a complicated process, recognizing you or someone you love needs help, and then finding a therapist or doctor who is taking new patients and accepts insurance. I want to hear from you. You can call us at 651-227-6000 or leave me a message at Angela Davis, NPR. I have two guests joining me in the studio today. We have Jen Lee Palin, who is the executive director of the Minnesota Association of Community Mental Health Programs, also known as MACMAP. Good morning, Jenny.
Good morning, Angela.
And we also have Dr. Pahua Yang, who is the Vice President of Community Mental Health and Wellness at the Wilder Foundation, which is a social services organization in St. Paul. Nice to see you, Dr. Yang.
Good morning.
So first of all, I think we all know, I think a lot of people know that there is a shortage of a lot of different kinds of professional workers. But why should we be particularly concerned about not enough mental health workers in communities across Minnesota? Why is this a big deal? Do you want to go first, Jenny?
Thank you, Angela. And I think this is becoming more and more a big deal as we're starting to recognize that mental health is very much a part of our overall health, and that this is the head is just as critical as any other physical part of our body. I think we are also in a moment now with a lot of increasing health epidemics around the mental and chemical health space. We're dealing with a lot going on with the opioid epidemic. We are dealing with quite a bit around continued substance use disorders, a growing recognition of increased mental health conditions. And I think part of that is really, as a society, we're also starting to recognize that there was recognized and addressing a lot of the stigma that historically had been placed around this particular part of our health.
So it's good that there's more awareness that, you know, getting treatment for mental health conditions is a good thing. But it's disappointing that people are struggling to find that help. Yep. Do you see that too, Dr. Yang?
Yes, absolutely. I certainly see it and hear about it from my colleagues who live in rural Minnesota. But we're right in St. Paul, and I see it every day in folks who also struggle in the metro area.
Right. And so in your mind, why is this a serious issue that we need to address?
Well, it impacts every part of our society. It's about how we care for each other, how we care for people who need help, how we care for family members, neighbors, people in our communities. It impacts just every part of how we function. So there's that part of why we should care about it, because there are very real and hidden costs, including just how people feel about the world. But right. There are some actual costs to folks who need you know, good mental health and substance use disorders care. But a lot of people often don't encounter that until they or their children or someone that they love needs help.
Yeah, when it becomes personal.
Absolutely.
So I referred to the Minnesota Department of Human Services as one source with some knowledge of these shortage of mental health professionals. But what are the two of you seeing or hearing from people about this problem? Any personal accounts of people just struggling to find someone who can provide some mental health counseling?
Yeah. Well, you know, what I would say is my organization, like a lot of mental health centers, had very, very long wait lists. And one of the things that we became a year and a half ago is we are one of the 6 certified community behavioral health clinics in the state of Minnesota. And we really changed how we were providing services as well as how we were bringing people in for services. That allowed us to be able to see people as they walk in or see people within 24 hours. And that really changed how we could respond to community need. And so, you know, that has really shifted how we're thinking about this. Now, we heard over and over and over from adults, from parents, caregivers of young children coming in who were saying, we can't get this in a lot of places. When we have the need, we're put on long wait lists. And unfortunately, that's still the world for people who aren't part of this wonderful pilot. Mm-hmm. That's still the world. And it's especially crucial for people for whom English is not their first language and for children.
So the hazards of sitting on a wait list, that's not a good thing if you need immediate care.
Can I add to that, too? I think we as a society and a system have built up a very complex, complicated health system, but also mental health system to navigate. And so in addition to being perhaps put on a wait list, if you then discover that you are also in need of other supportive services like home services mm-hmm. or other transportation needs or housing needs or supportive housing needs, for every one of those services, for the vast part of our system, you have to then be re-referred and navigate a really complex kind of spider web of being able to get yourself to all of these different places in order to receive those services that you need. We live in a really siloed, very segmented way that we've set up our healthcare system, which is, I think, complicating the factor.
So, Jenny, you're with the Minnesota Association of Community Mental Health Programs. What role do community mental health programs fill in the overall mental health care system?
We are in that space where, one, we are safety net providers, and so we take it on as our mission and our charge to really serve folks who otherwise would not have access to these really critical community-based services. We're also community-based, and we pride ourselves on serving our clients with a comprehensive array of services. So to the extent that we can, we try to eliminate a lot of those extra barriers in having to be re-referred and navigate that complex system by saying, we will do what we can to help you get through that and hold your hand and lead you through that system and offer you those services right in our house. Within our clinic if we have that.
So if you're just joining us, we are talking about the shortage of mental health workers to meet the demand for help. We want to invite you to join the conversation. If you've had to overcome some type of hurdle to get some type of mental health professional to work with you or a family member, we'd love to hear your story. If you have a question, give us a call. The number is 651-227-6000, or you can leave me a message on Twitter. I'm at Angela Davis, NPR. Right now, I want to invite Lauren, who is listening in St. Paul, to share her question. Good morning, Lauren.
Good morning. Thank you so much for having me. Mine's more of a story than a question, but sure. I just wanted to comment. This really resonates with me. I actually, both in my professional and personal life, deal with this. I'm a case manager and work in mental health. And so I spend pretty much my whole day, doing research to try to find providers who have openings or who take this insurance or, you know, can be flexible with their schedule for this need for this client or that client and to help people get connected. And I see, you know, how hard it is for my clients to get connected. And then kind of the big irony of this is that this is what I do in my professional life. And then even in my personal life as well. I'm trying to find a therapist right now, and it's been several months. I've been bounced around from, you know, getting re-referred from a therapist to another therapist because one doesn't take my insurance, or one can't meet my scheduling needs, or, you know, so many don't have openings, or, you know, certain places that I refer a lot of clients to because I want to keep my, you know, professional kind of boundaries. I have to watch where I go so that I don't actually run into, you know, a client there. So it's a real challenge. And I find that it's, you know, particularly here in the Twin Cities, I mean, I definitely see that being a huge barrier.
Thank you, Lauren. So what she just described, is that a common scenario that people just wait, get bounced around? Is that what you also see in here?
Unfortunately, it can be. I think as a system, we try to work together to not have that be the experience, but that's not atypical.
And there are many providers who do not accept insurance. So that's got to create a difficulty for a lot of people too.
Absolutely. And for someone like Lauren, you know, I can absolutely understand because she probably sends many clients to organizations like the Wilder Foundation because we take everybody regardless of their ability to pay. However, as someone who also works in the field, it really resonates with me that she would not want to come to the places that she is also referring clients, because you also want to protect that space for your clients and protect that space for yourself. That's something that I hear a lot from other folks who work in the field, is they know what organizations could be flexible enough for them to receive services, but those are the very same organizations that they may be sending their own clients or their students, and they want to make sure that those folks still feel comfortable going there.
And Jenny, do you hear stories too about people who struggle to find a provider who accepts insurance, or people having, you know, difficulty making payments that they can't afford this help that they need?
We do, absolutely. And I think that is where a majority of our members through MACMAP have really found their calling, because there is an overall lack of being able to get into a lot of providers who will see different, who will see different insurance coverages. And as community mental health centers, we will, as Dr. Yang said, we'll never turn anyone away based on their ability to pay for their care or their insurance status.
Another listener is on the phone right now. Kat is in St. Paul. Good morning, Kat.
Hi. Good morning.
Hi. Go ahead. You're on.
So I recently got a therapist for the first time in about 10 years and was diagnosed with PTSD. It took me 6 months to find a therapist, and I nearly gave up multiple times. And the one I eventually found is a recent grad, is the only reason that she had any availability, and is not in my network. So I'm paying mostly out of pocket. And the need was so intense that is necessary for me, but it's also an incredible financial strain to get the help that I need.
Thank you, Kat. So how did we get into this situation? Has it, over the last few years, become worse? Or how did we get here that we end up with more patients, you know, seeking mental health care than trained professionals who seem to be able to offer it in a timely fashion? What seems to have led up to this point?
Well, if I may, I just wanted to address what Kat had mentioned around the lack of having her insurance and being cover it and being part of that network. We are in a really, I think, interesting time in that we have a standing parity law here in the state of Minnesota that says that all commercial coverage must cover mental health services in the same way that they cover physical health services. Where we are still trying to evolve and move things forward is that trying to find strong mechanisms to really enforce that law so that we truly have the same kind of coverage for the services for mental health that we would have otherwise for physical health.
Dr. Yang, your thoughts about just the difficulty in paying for these services?
Absolutely. I would agree with what Jenny just said. I would also say, when I think about the shortage areas for workforce, for mental health workforce, most of Minnesota qualifies is those shortage areas. The Twin Cities does not. However, when I think about how difficult it is in the Twin Cities, even in an area that seems like we should have a plethora of mental health providers, those insurance issues come into play all the time. And so we have the parity law, but we also have a lot of providers who choose not to be part of networks because of some of the various barriers that being part of networks can pose. And so you find yourself, you know, in even in the Twin Cities, in a place where we, in theory, don't have a shortage of mental health professionals, needing to navigate who will take insurance and who won't. And unless you can pull out a checkbook and write a check, it's difficult.
And it's time consuming, because if you're working, you know, when do you make all of these calls, or people may be calling you back and, you know, trying to get these calls, you know, when you're free, you could spend time just playing phone tag for a long time.
Absolutely.
Right. Matt in St. Paul is listening and also would like to chime in the conversation. Good morning, Matt.
Hi. Good to have you.
Hi.
I'm a student at the University of Minnesota system, and one of the difficulties I face with $20,000 a year tuition is getting mental health care. Mm-hmm. After suffering a panic attack, difficult enough that my fiance considered calling an ambulance, I went to Boynton Health Services to try to secure some counseling, and I was told that I couldn't be seen for 39 days.
Wow.
And suffice to say, it was longer than that before I was able to secure regular therapy. And something that was difficult to confront was that I am actively paying for these services already as part of my tuition, and they still couldn't see me for more than 2 months.
That's I'm sorry to hear that, Matt. And so when people are left in this situation, what can they do? Are there any other resources that you can go to while you are waiting to you know, get on someone's you know, get an appointment with someone? Like, what are you supposed to do while you're waiting?
You know, that's a great question. I think there are some things that we have in place, but mm-hmm. I think quite honestly, a lot of people suffer. Mm-hmm. A lot of people suffer quietly, and they try to do other things to help ameliorate what they're going through. Sometimes then people show up in emergency rooms or, you know, in crisis somewhere else. And that is the really unfortunate piece of this, is we know that the longer we put someone on a wait list, the higher likelihood they are to go into crisis. And that's not acceptable for any of us. You know, when you need help, you need help. It's not acceptable to be put on a wait list. And yet I know that that's what people have to do in order to work in the current system that we have.
So when we look at the type of mental health professionals, so first, I guess I want to try to define like the different type of people who provide this work, because there are all kinds of different jobs. So there are therapists, there are psychologists, social workers. What are the could you help me with some of the terms? Like, what's the difference between if I'm looking for care, a therapist and someone who's a psychologist or a psychiatrist? Can you help us sort of define these terms within mental health?
Absolutely. It depends on what you're looking for. And so therapist is a general term for someone who delivers mental health treatment. Mm-hmm. A psychiatrist is a medical doctor who has an additional specialty training in mental health, and they can prescribe, but they're also trained as therapists. Mm-hmm. A psychologist is typically a doctoral level person who's trained also to provide therapy, but may have additional competency in psychological testing and assessment. A lot of therapists in our state tend to be master's level folks who have who are from the field, various fields like social work, counseling, marriage and family therapy. Forgetting okay. some.
And then, and social workers.
Yes.
You mentioned social workers as well. And so, Jenny, when I'm looking for care, what should be my guiding force? Like, what should I be, you know, specifically looking for when trying to match what my needs with who would be the best person to provide that kind of care? Any advice you would offer there?
Well, that is a really great question. I think I would have to, I would say start by trying to see who your local community mental health center is and see what you can do about contacting someone there. Mm-hmm. And I say that, well, two, one, because they are, I truly believe they are a fantastic model, but they also, because they offer that comprehensive service array and are the providers who will most often take new clients and new insurance and find ways to get those services. They can connect folks, I think, if they can't deliver the services themselves.
And there are providers who have specialties, too. There are people who specialize in working with children and teenagers. There are people who specialize in working, I imagine, with veterans or with women or people of color. And that's another, I guess, even a deeper dimension to this is when you're searching for someone to provide mental health help, if you're a person of color and you would like a person of color to talk to, the numbers get even, I think, more daunting. Is that correct?
Yes, absolutely. So there's a workforce shortage overall in mental health, and it becomes magnified if you're looking for someone from a specific cultural community or who has maybe a specific language skill set.
Mm-hmm. And that, and in some communities, in immigrant communities, that the language barriers, that's a big deal.
Absolutely, it is.
Could you tell me like what you see with that?
Well, I think it's hard to communicate if you don't speak the same language as your treatment right. provider. And then if you don't have qualified and skilled interpreters mm-hmm. to navigate that relationship. You know, I've been on both sides of the interpreting. And I know that when you can speak the same language as your provider, things don't get missed as often. That's not to say it can't happen, because all of us, because of what our workforce looks like, do that all the time. You have to be trained and have some knowledge about how to work and do therapy via an interpreter. But then I think you run into many other things, like the shortage of interpreters, especially for some right. of the languages that we're seeing. You may miss nuances. The relationship takes a while to build. And so there are many other barriers.
A couple of years ago, NPR News, we reported that in a 2015 study on the state's mental health workforce, only 1% of Minnesota's licensed social workers identified as Latino and 2% as Black. And social workers are the state's most common licensed mental health profession. So that's just really stunning if when you look at communities of color, what they're facing in trying to find someone that they could, talk to and, start the conversation at a different place. Right. Deb is listening in St. James, one of our callers on the line. Good morning, Deb. You have a question or a comment?
I have a comment and a mm-hmm. question. My comment is that in our small town, there aren't a lot of choices. We do have a counseling center, but the turnover is super high. And I think one of the reasons why is the demand they have on documentation. It's a chain, and they require, all this extra non-patient stuff. And some of the older therapists, they just can't hack the computer work. And I think that's kind of a shame to lose them. And then another resource is to do teleconferencing. And I'm wondering if that's as effective as in person.
All right. That's Deb in St. James talking about being in a rural community. Teleconference therapy. What is that? Could you tell us more about that option?
Telemedicine is... I don't want to say it's new, but I think it's relatively new in how it's becoming more popular and mm-hmm. being seen as a great alternative to in-house staffing. And so it's the ability for a provider to interact with a client over a live video screen
right.
In the same way that they would if they were in an in-person face-to-face visit. They're just separated by, in some cases, hundreds of miles. I think it's a great alternative for a lot of things, but I also don't want to oversell it in that it cannot be the fix-all for everything. You still have to have that tangible client-provider relationship with that in-person provides.
Are we starting to see that teleconferencing or teletherapy being used more? Do you hear more about it?
We're seeing, I think, a lot of it, a growth for it really in greater Minnesota and in our rural areas, just because of the geographic challenges that mm-hmm. providers and communities in greater Minnesota have. And I think there is where it's probably gaining probably some of the most of its
of its traction.
And Dr. Yang, I also, you know, as I was reading about this last night, I've read reports that depression rates in rural counties are quite high. The Minnesota Department of Health, in a study in 2005, they reported as high as 40% in rural counties compared to about 20% in urban areas. So what is the big difference with rural areas and urban areas when it comes to depression, your understanding?
I'm not sure, you know, what I think might be happening is just, again, we go back to that access to care. Mm-hmm. And so if we think we're having issues in the metro area, I think our rural colleagues and our rural communities mm-hmm. have different challenges that they're really navigating through.
And if I may, I can only mm-hmm. really kind of speak from my personal experience. I grew up in northern Minnesota in a very small kind of rural mining town. And I think there's a different cultural aspect in some of these communities where you're in a small town that is roughly isolated from a lot of other towns. Everyone kind of knows each other. And so the ability to have anonymity goes away quite a bit in some of these smaller towns. And feeling that you can be more open about some of these things, I think there's just a different culture and a different perception of mental health in some of these communities as well.
So we do have some calls I want to get to. Evan is listening in La Porte, Minnesota. Good morning, Evan.
Good morning, Angela. How are you?
I'm good. Go ahead.
Hey, I'm a doctoral student. I'll be a psychiatric mental health nurse practitioner in a couple years here. One of the things I wanted to say was that this shortage really forces us to be reactive with mental health versus proactive. You know, if you think about diabetes, if you didn't treat it for 3 months, you could run into all sorts of issues. The same could be said for depression or schizophrenia or bipolar disorder. And, you know, I think one of the things that we're really failing on is our education of healthcare workers. So when I was in nursing school, I went to one clinical rotation. It was an acute psychiatric hospital. And that really only shows one side. You don't really get to see the outpatient setting, the therapy setting, different things like that. So I think that could be a focus in the future here.
All right. That's Evan. So we were talking about the spectrum of mental health workers. There are all kinds of people who can provide support. So tell me, who is out there that is offering this kind of help in addition to the therapists and the doctors? Who else is doing this kind of work that could help sort of meet the need?
Absolutely. So it's important to think about, we've talked about some of the licensed mental health professionals in our state, but our mental health system is made up of a lot more people than that. They are made up of case managers. They are made up of certified peer specialists. They are made up of community health workers, care coordinators, a lot of other folks who can support the health and well-being of an individual or a family. And those are other ways that we can think about how we fill the gap of mental health staff in our state, is to really say we've got all these multidisciplinary folks that we can bring together to support the people who need and want it in our state. And how do we work on not just having all these people come to the table to work together, but how do we work on diversifying? Because there are certain professions that are going to draw from different communities. And how do we really capitalize on that?
Jenny?
I think especially when we're talking about the certified peer specialists or the community health workers, I think they play a very crucial role in that they oftentimes come from the communities, from these very diverse cultural communities that they're then going back to serve as they see it as a professional calling, but also as just a calling to give back to their communities. Certified peer specialists, I think in particular, bring the value of having someone with a lived experience be able to work with clients who also share that experience to resonate with them on a different, more personal level, in addition to having the skills to help them through their crises.
And so when we look at this workforce, there are some barriers that keep people from getting into this line of work who might be great at it. I've read that the licensing exam can be a problem. Can you speak to that?
Absolutely. What I will confess to is prior to taking on one of the roles that I had at the Wilder Foundation, which was really the management of a wonderful program we have that supports the licensure of clinicians of color, I had no idea how significant this issue was until I began to see both people at Wilder as well as people in the community time after time miss the national exams by 1 or 2 points. It was never very large. And I saw that for all professions. It wasn't like it was specific to the social worker test or to the marriage and family test or to the psychology test. I was seeing it in pretty significant ways from large communities of color. And I've been worried about that for a long time, because where that leads me to is to look at what are we really measuring with the licensure exams that we have out there. Mm-hmm. And if we have disproportionate groups of people who aren't passing it, and these are people who are really well qualified, clinically qualified, who are incredible mental health professionals, but they're not passing the licensure exam, it's mm-hmm. time to look at that and say, what's really going on? What are we really testing? And why do we have these large populations who aren't passing?
So, Jenny, is that a missed opportunity? Are we missing out on a lot of people who would be great working in this field because of this exam?
I think so, absolutely. I think it's this is an almost missed opportunity. I think we still have the great opportunity to work with our partners across the licensing boards and with other stakeholders to find other ways to be able to get these folks into the profession. I think the exam can be an important component of that, but I also think that there's a lot of other alternative ways that we can support these clinicians to make sure that the competencies are still there without them being perhaps barred from being able to get into the profession. I also want to add that I think in addition to them having to complete the licensing exam, once they are in the field, we have a lot of different safe gaps or safeguards, if you will, to ensure that there's compliance and best practices and that the safety of the clients are always first. And so I think with all of that working in the background, there can be other ways for folks to be able to get in the door.
Mary is listening in Minneapolis and is on the phone. Good morning, Mary.
Hi, thank you very much.
Go right ahead.
Okay, I wanted to address a question that perhaps came up a little while ago about what do people do when they can't get in for an appointment and have to wait and so forth. And I just want to let the listeners know that there is an alternative, at least as for many people in and around the Twin Cities, and that is Walk-In Counseling Center. We offer free, anonymous if a person chooses to be, and no appointment services during our walk-in clinics. All you have to do is come and be willing to talk about the issue that brought you there.
And that's in Minneapolis?
It's in Minneapolis, but we have two sites in St. Paul as well. And so every weekday, Monday through Friday, there is a walk-in clinic available, sometimes two or three, that people can go to.
And what is it called again, Mary?
It's called Walk-In, Walk-In Counseling Center. We've been around for 50 years. This is our 50th anniversary year. All of the work is done by clinical professionals, people who volunteer to do this work, to make sure that people who don't have good access otherwise have access through Walk-In Counseling Center. We might be a first step for someone who has never, ever thought about counseling but end up in a crisis for some reason. We could bridge between the time a person realizes they have a crisis but mm-hmm. they can't see a clinician at their clinic for 3 or 4 weeks. We might bridge that gap in time so at least they have some support in between.
All right.
So there's lots of alternatives of how and why people get here.
That's wonderful. Thank you. That's Mary calling from Minneapolis. And I know that there's also a concern of with our existing mental health professionals. We need younger folks, right? We need to create an entry point to the profession to younger people. There's an opportunity there.
Absolutely. When I look at some of our statistics, particularly of some of our licensed mental health professionals and what percentage in our state is over a certain age. It says we have to figure out how to draw more young people, more new people into the field, so that we don't continue to face even deeper disparities as, you know, in the coming years. We do have to talk about, though, how our mental health system is put together. I don't feel like we have intentionally resourced our mental health system and built it in the way that we need to build in order to attract providers, in order for providers to be able to afford to come into the field and do the important work that we need them to do.
On Twitter, Nina writes, don't forget to mention that a lot of employers offer EAP, which is the Employee Assistance Program, at no cost to their employees, which often include counseling. So what's your read on the employee assistance programs? People that I know who've reached out have had great experiences with them. Is that a good alternative while you're waiting to get in to see someone?
I would say I personally believe there's no wrong door, no wrong entry. And so if people are finding that they're having positive experiences with that, I would say by all means, go with what works.
Okay. Shannon is listening in Fergus Falls. Good morning, Shannon.
Hello.
Hi, go ahead.
I was just hoping you would share some information about the mobile mental health teams located around the state of Minnesota.
Mobile health teams. So there are people who go out and visit communities and sort of bring mental health services to where people are. Do you know much about those?
I can speak a little bit to the mobile crisis teams, which are part of a program across the state. In fact, I believe all community mental health centers participate in that. And that is a model where a mental health clinician goes out with first responders or goes out on 911 calls. And when those calls refer to someone who is in a mental health crisis, and they're able to work with that person to de-escalate the situation and start giving them some initial services and then get them referred into some longer-term treatment. It's an area, I think, where we've had some success and have some more growing opportunities to work more collaboratively with our folks in the police area and the corrections area so that we can start to really get folks to the right point of care or the right endpoint, rather than some folks, as we're finding now, oftentimes ending up in corrections or in jails because there feels like there's no other resource to respond to some of those crisis calls. So mobile crisis teams are a great resource.
Again, we're talking about the shortage of mental health workers across Minnesota. If you've got a story to share about, a hurdle that you've had to deal with to get the care that you need for yourself or a loved one, we'd love to hear it. The number is 651-227-6000, or you can leave me a message on Twitter. I'm at Angela Davis, MPR. Mary is on the phone listening as well. Mary is in Minneapolis. Good morning. Go ahead.
Hi, I am a licensed social worker and very new into this field. And I'm finding that one of the major disparities in terms of getting people of color or people that have access to less funding and opportunities is, people who are reimbursed by insurance have to go through grad school, have to take the licensing exam, have to pay licensing fees, then have to pay supervision fees. And it's all very expensive. And it's not super congruent with the actual salary that I'm paid. So I only get reimbursed per client at the agency that I'm at and don't get reimbursed for talking to other professionals on the phone or collaboration or even case notes. It is really, really hard to make ends meet in terms of being in the profession and being able to come out ahead financially. And I've heard from a lot of my classmates in grad school that the people who generally don't pass the licensing exam are the ones who don't have English as their first language. And so that's a major barrier. Mm-hmm. So one of the suggestions that I have is to work systemically with insurance to start reimbursing for individuals who are mental health professionals who maybe aren't licensed or don't have a master's degree, but peer support specialists.
All right, that's Mary. So she says that the pay is not very good, and that can create a problem for people who are interested in doing this kind of work and choose to do something else. What do you see? What are you hearing with that, the pay?
I would agree. I was trying to express that when I said before that we have not invested in building our system. And the whole reimbursement, as well as then for employers like myself, you know, I have salaried positions, but I know painfully that because of how we are reimbursed in a mental health system, what I can afford to pay, and I think we're pretty competitive, but what I can afford to pay is not what larger systems or other systems pay. And it is very expensive to go through graduate school and do all the things you need to do in order to end up as a licensed mental health professional.
This is unfortunately not uncommon across our industry. We are finding that across all of our different payer mixes, the costs of providing these services are vastly outgrowing our reimbursement rates. And another additional concern there is some of our key services that we provide in our mental health industry are not even reimbursable through some traditional insurance or payment reimbursement mechanisms. And so we have some very key programs that are still being funded majoritively through competitive grants at the state level, which continues to be one of the challenges that we deal with in this particular system. I do want to throw a shout out to the new administration. I think where their new budget is moving, their budget proposal for this year.
The state of Minnesota,
the Governor Walz's administration is moving things in the right direction, and we're excited to see where that goes.
So on Twitter, Amy writes, let's talk about education requirements for mental health workers. What degrees, et cetera, does a person need to get into the field? So what are the options? What could you study in college that would prepare you for this type of work? A lot of choices.
There are many choices, many choices. And so, again, it depends on who we're talking about and what we're talking about, because, for example, if you want to be a community health worker who specializes in mental health, that may be a year-long certification program. If you want to be a certified peer specialist, the requirements there are, you know, being an adult who has lived experience, mm-hmm. who has then some additional training and supervision in order to deliver services to other folks. If you want to be what we call a therapist, most of the time you're going to get a master's degree at minimum.
So that's many years in school.
Yes.
For this type of career. Another caller we have who's listening, Beth in St. Paul. And Beth, you are a mental health professional. Is that correct?
Yes, I am.
Hi,
can
go
you
ahead.
Hear me?
Yes, we can hear you. You're on. Go ahead.
Great. Yes. Yeah, I've been listening to the program. I'm lucky enough to be able to do that today. But I've been in private practice in St. Paul for 30 years, and I also work at a college. But my comment is, when I went into the field, both social workers, psychologists, marriage and family, although that license wasn't there yet, part of our kind of understanding and ethical guidelines were to always offer a portion of our practices to low-income or sliding fee scale for people who couldn't, get access elsewhere. And it has literally gone out the window, being that the reimbursement rates from insurance have cut our rates in even less than half. So to make ends meet now for a lot of people, you're seeing, 25, 30, 35 clients a week in order to make the kind of living that one used to. I mean, we all still try to do that, but it's gotten a lot harder. And a shout out to Mary Weeks at Walk-In Counseling, who just called. That's a wonderful mm-hmm. organization. And Wilder, all of you are doing such a wonderful job of helping get this to happen. But it is really, the insurance companies have a huge part in this. Our reimbursement rates are way down. I agree with what everyone said. So that's really a big, big piece that is affecting the market, I think.
Beth, I have a question for you. What do you think needs to happen to turn things around so that people do have access to more mental health professionals and mental health professionals, stay in the field and continue to expand their services?
I this is where everyone cringes, but insurance companies, something's got to give there because they control the market and they control who gets in as providers. So when people say providers won't participate, sometimes they won't because they can't afford to. We are subsidizing insurance companies. But the other thing is that sometimes people are not let into those networks to provide service. But anyway, I mean, that's a big, you know, 20,000-foot picture, but I do think that affects it. And I think the community mental health system needs to build again. It was there before. I work at a college also. We send enormous numbers of people, you know, and try to refer around to the right services. But I think community mental health needs to pick up again. And wherever the cash is for that, maybe the Walls administration will help with that. I just really highly respect what all of you are doing. We just can't meet the needs. Colleges, I work at a college also. College mental health never was in existence. It has had to become more in existence because of how much mental health need there is, and they're starting to make budgets for that. But college mental health centers can't cover it all either and have to refer out for the more difficult situations. It's complicated. I guess the answer is to find most people go into the field are very satisfied. Mm-hmm. They went into the field because they want to be in the field. But I think it becomes impossible at times.
Why? Because you still have to. It's a profession. It's a job for you. You've got to be able to earn your income as well.
You know, do all the things we all need to do. But anyway,
thank you, Beth. Thank you.
Negative, but
No. Yeah, thank you. You provided some valuable insight. We appreciate it. Wow. There's a lot to cover here. There really is. We have Elliot from St. Paul who is listening. And Elliot, you had a question about different ways that you can receive help. Good morning.
Morning. So I personally have PTSD and bipolar disorder and borderline personality disorder, a lot of things that are mental health issues. So I talk to a lot of people with mental health, and I see that some of them are going to these apps where there's supposedly a licensed caregiver on the other side, and they can go anytime and they can talk. And I find that kind of, for people like myself with more complex situations, mm-hmm. I find that kind of, it makes me nervous when I hear these people talking. Some of them have suicidal ideation, some of them have some more advanced problems, and they see these things that are being advertised to them as apps that, you know, it's a good way to get counseling and stuff like that. What do you guys, I mean, what is your take on the dark side of technology instead of, you know, doctors going through video, but apps and not really being able to see the person and, you know.
Okay, that's Elliot from St. Paul. I had not heard of the apps. I mean, I know there are phone lines you can call and talk to people, but texting with a therapist, is that an option that some people use?
The state of Minnesota does have a program where folks who are in very acute crisis can mm-hmm. text in. The purpose mm-hmm. of that is not to go through a whole therapy session over text. It is to quickly get someone into referral to longer-term
like
face-to-face
services. An emergency.
An emergency mm-hmm. text, yep, to connect folks to the services that they need.
And I must admit, as a mental health provider, as a psychologist, I don't know enough about the apps that are available. Mm-hmm. I would caution folks to fully really look at who is providing that app and for what purpose mm-hmm. before people dive in. I do think we are, you know, we have huge opportunities to really leverage technology in a different way. And this really, we need a multi-pronged approach to addressing the workforce shortage. And so I am open to really looking at all ways that are possible, but I simply don't know enough about mm-hmm. what the apps are out there and who's putting them out to say right now one way or another, except know what we're getting into.
And when we look at, is it true? Do you find it's true that more people are seeking out help and acknowledging, you know, I could benefit from getting some mental health support? And I think that's a good thing to hang on to, that we're talking about it and people are seeking out help. Is that you're feeling
yes.
as well?
The wonderful mm-hmm. thing. I mean, I've been a therapist for 20 years, and the wonderful thing that I see now is people are much more open. There's still huge stigma, but compared to 20 years ago, people are much more open to trying to find help and hopefully doing it earlier mm-hmm. Because we don't want people to suffer for a long time quietly. And so there is some openness in our society. There's some recognition that all of us can benefit, but we still also have a lot of stigma.
Right. We've taken a step forward. Well, thank you for your time and thank you for sharing your expertise on mental health professionals and making sure we have enough people available to help those who are reaching out for some type of assistance. Our guest today, Jin Lee Paling, Executive Director at the Minnesota Association of Community Mental Health Programs, and Dr. Pahua Yang, a Vice President of Community Mental Health and Wellness at the Wilder Foundation. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
You just heard a recording of a live radio show on NPR News. To add your voice to the conversation, you can call in at 651-227-6000 or tweet us at Angela Davis MPR. And if you miss us live, you'll find all of our shows by subscribing to this podcast. You can send us your questions or comments by emailing talk@npr.org.